time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? But I hadn't been for Cotton Eye Joe. I've been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe?
We kick off hour number two of the program. Supposed to be Optimism Tuesday. Having a hard time with it. I don't know what. It's kind of hard to break down baseball for, you know, swimming. You want to repeat?
No, they're champs.
The swimming breakdown. It's over.
Swimming is a fun Olympic sport to watch, though.
Agree.
You go with that.
Don't we have Olympics this summer?
Yeah, that's why I said it.
That'll be fun.
I love the Olympics.
I do too.
I've realized that because when I was a little kid, we didn't have cable. That's why I love all these random, just out-of-the-way sports. The more random, the better.
That's why you're a big Notre Dame fan?
That too.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm not a big Notre Dame fan.
Sure, yeah.
I grew up. I learned the mistakes of my ways.
A lot of people are mad at the Barnes bashing. Like, Everyone just breathe.
What?
Like, come these on. Are these are snapshot takes. It's one game. This isn't 10,000 feet view. I don't think anybody who's upset about Rick Barnes in the Auburn game and some of his quotes after games this season is saying, fire Rick Barnes. He's the worst coach ever. There are just questions being brought up about in-game coaching. I do think this year has been very, very weird. It's been, as Philip Fulmer said, it's challenging. I'm sure Rick Barnes didn't expect this. I don't know how any coach could expect this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to worry about Plavsic. Then you lose Lamonte. Then you get Vescovi. Then you get Plavsic. Then you lose James. It's been a new team seemingly every week. It's tough to find a rhythm. It's tough to really, I mean, they've, I don't know how many different starting lineups they've had. It seems like it's been quite a few. Like, I'm not giving him a pass on the mistakes because I think he has made some, but I am giving him a 10,000 foot pass on this season has just been weird. It's been bizarre. It's really been bizarre for the SEC and nationally. I mean, look at the top 25. Look at all the non-Power 5, Power 6 schools that are having really great years. It's just one of those weird things where you kind of got snake bit a few different times and so I guess in a way, like, that's good. Even with all that's gone on, you've been in games like Auburn and Kentucky late. And I think this is just part of having a young team and a player like Bowden who was in a big slump. They don't know how to finish. When the pressure gets ratcheted up, they make mistakes. And I'm hopeful that the players that are making those mistakes this year, players like Vescovi, like Pons, like James, next year, with a more seasoned basketball IQ, we don't see these mistakes, not to mention the influx of talent that you're going to have. But I still think it's okay to point out issues when you see them. I mean, that's how we know whether or not they're getting corrected.
It's okay to critique and criticize without wanting someone fired.
Right. Or saying that they're just the worst ever, but we're stuck with them. And I don't think anybody here said that. Like Nate said it yesterday. Rick Barnes was the right coach for Tennessee. He still is the right coach for Tennessee. Doesn't mean he's perfect. But
he made mistakes on Saturday. He just did. I mean, it's okay. You can even, if you want to give him a pass, you still have to say, well, he made mistakes, but he didn't know that that's what was going to happen. I mean, there's a difference in grading someone's decision-making when they don't know the future, and then grading it after the fact.
Yeah.
And coaching decisions are always like that. If I'm a football coach and I decide to go for it on fourth down and we don't make it, well,
you're an idiot.
Either the decision was wrong or the play call was wrong or like something.
Or the execution was wrong. Like there's like
something.
Yeah.
Somebody made a mistake and that's okay.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Like Barnes isn't the one out there turning the ball over. He's not the one, you know, dribbling it off his foot. He's not the one fouling 90 feet away from the basket. I know he's told the guys, hey, don't do those things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, in my opinion, probably could have called a timeout, tried to settle everybody down. But to his point, and look, that's the decision he made. We're just discussing the decision and kind of grading the decision after the fact. got sent an interesting tweet. Matt Reese sent me this. This is from the let's see, when did Auburn play North Carolina? Was that the Elite Eight or was that the Sweet 16?
I thought it was the Sweet 16, Sweet 16. And then they beat Kentucky in the Elite Eight.
Okay, yeah. That's right. There was an article on Auburn Undercover in which Bruce Pearl said he had no plan to react with a quick timeout should his team fall behind against North Carolina in the Sweet 16. He will not pause if his team gives up a scoring run that leads to a double-digit deficit at some point in the game. That's not his style. It never has been. So there's the guy we're all clamoring for, Jamie, saying the exact same thing. Like, no, if you give up a big run and you lose a deficit or you have now a big deficit of your own, I'm not going to call a timeout. I'm not going to save you. Play through it. Like, there are coaches who do that, who just say, nope, whatever. Play through it. Figure it out.
Well, I think,
but I would say last year's Auburn team was a much more experienced group than this team, and that's where...
They also weren't on the road. It was a neutral site game.
True.
Well, and early Bruce Pearl, I can tell you this because he said these things, he's more concerned with the style of the game. If he has the tempo where he wants it, if his guys are getting the shots he wants them to get, if he's forcing, even if the, and back when they pressed all the time, even if he gave up some layups and the other team was kind of going on a run, but he'd gotten them out of their half court game and gotten the game up and down into more transition, he that's what he wanted. So that's why he would not want to call a timeout and let the game continue.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough if you're a coach. Like, I don't know what the magic number is. Like, what's the call a timeout run? I mean, I guess it's going to be different depending on your team, where you're playing, who your opponent is. I mean, that's why in my head, once it got cut from 17 to 12, I probably would have called a timeout. But I think that's right around the time the media time. What did you say it was? Was it 10 points when the media timeout came? So if you're waiting for the media timeout, okay. But then once it gets to 10 or 9 or whatever it was after that, I probably would have taken another one.
I think you got 7 after the media timeout. So
that's probably when you take it.
Especially with the young team, I think that's the part that disappoints me the most, and Nate's alluded to this multiple times, is he doesn't change the way he coaches despite the players on the floor or on the roster.
Well, and I do think that in the long term, that might not be a bad thing. Once these players have experience, they know the system, they're more, you know, adept at handling these types of situations. I mean, this was what he said about last year's team all the time. Like, I want them to play through stuff. I want them to kind of figure it out on their own. I don't want to overcoach them. I don't want to, you know, save them when things are scaring me, because I know that these are tough guys who have the ability to play out of it. So that's why, and I know people don't like it, but this may be a case kind of similar to what we said about Jeremy Pruitt in year one. Like, we're going to do what we do. We're going to get our butt kicked a couple times, but in year two, people will see that that stuff pays off. And then same thing last year. We're going to do what we do. And in the end of the year, it's going to be paying off. And it actually did.
I feel like you can say that sometimes with the style of play you're trying to instill in guys. But calling a timeout, like having guys play through a run that you could at least help them slow down, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, they're going to gain the same road game experience either way. So that's like, I don't understand why you wouldn't give your guys a better chance to win the game that they're playing right then, when you're not, it's not like you're having to take anything away from them to do that. You know, the football analogy we were talking about, do you run a simpler scheme now because it might give you a better chance to win, or do you instill kind of the style of play you want to play for the long haul? Like, that makes perfect sense, but like calling a timeout is just something you do. You don't have to take any teaching time away from your kids to do that. I mean, they're going to play through tough runs no matter what. I mean, I think what's frustrating kind of people on the back end is that, you know, Captain Touchback tweeted in, so a question to Barnes about what he would do gets an answer about how the players didn't do their job. And then he says, that's not a championship coach, and that's not breaking news.
Corey tweets in, I think this is a really good point. He says, it can make sense to not call a timeout if you're still able to run your offense and to get your shots and they're just not falling. But Saturday, we couldn't even dribble the ball up the court. That's why we needed a timeout. I agree with that.
Great point.
Like, it's one thing to just be missing shots, although sometimes I think if you're just missing a bunch of shots, a timeout to calm everybody down can be a good thing. But, yeah, this team, we couldn't even get the ball across half court. And that's when me as a coach, I would try to calm everybody down.
Yeah, you're shook. Like, you're not playing your brand of basketball.
I mean, and I'll give Auburn credit. Like, that's not a big arena, but it was a sellout crowd. They had been waiting for something to explode on for a while. Mm-hmm. They got 5 quick points, and Vescovi got the 4th foul, and at that point, it was like blood in the water. Oh, they lost their ball handler on a cheap foul that I went back and rewatched yesterday, and I still don't think it was a foul. He had no business even being in position to draw a foul there, but he did. But yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, I think anybody who's watched Auburn or a Bruce Pearl team knows that they go on those runs. Like, they're just those moments in the game where sometimes it's early and they bury you quick. Look at North Carolina. Sometimes, and this year they've done it a lot. They've been tremendous in overtime. They've been tremendous when they've been down late in the second half. I said it Friday. I was like, this is the one team where no lead is safe, because once they get going, they can light it up in a hurry. And it's weird. It's almost like he goes back to last year's game plan, and this team can actually still operate that way. Remember last year, they didn't really turn it on in that barrage of three stuff until later in the year, once they got everybody mm-hmm. back and healthy. And this team, you know, you see it. Like, they have that ability, too. They can just win a lot of games without having to, you know, rely on that type of play. I do think this Auburn team is very, very good. And let's not forget, once they get Okoro back, they're going to be even better. Yeah, it was just a tough... You know, I think if you had gone into this game and said Tennessee's going to lose by 6, nobody's going to be upset. But when you blow the 17-point lead that quickly without a timeout, it just gives everybody something to kind of anchor on. But the fact that they went to Auburn, again, we've said it, young, inexperienced team, and we're up by 17, like, that gives me hope that once you do limit mistakes on the back end, this team is good enough, talented enough. Granted, this was with Jordan Bowden chipping in 28 points, 17 in the first half. Like, there's talent here. There's the ability to play with anyone in the country. Kansas is probably going to be your new number one after they beat Baylor. You played with Kansas. You've played with Kentucky. You've played with Auburn. Like, you're right there. You're just not as experienced, deep, or talented as those teams are right now.
I thought the polls came out yesterday. Kansas is number one.
They are? Okay. And they, I mean, based on what they did to Baylor, they should be. That was Baylor's second loss outside of Washington in game one. Kansas is playing really well right now. But, I mean,
well, one of the...
that's the frustrating thing, though, is you see them play against Kansas, Auburn, Kentucky, and they're right there, and then they lose to Texas A&M, South Carolina, Mississippi State. Those are the frustrating things. But I think that's just what happens with an inconsistent team. They're talented enough to kind of play up, maybe not good enough to beat those teams. If they can find that consistency and play that way every night, yeah, you're probably not going to consistently beat teams like Kansas, like Auburn, like Kentucky, but then you're not worrying about games against Mississippi State, Texas A&M, Arkansas tomorrow night. And I think that's the next jump for this team, not to mention the talent you add to next year's roster. I'm optimistic. I just, it's okay to, after a loss, point to something that you think could have gone differently.
Yeah, and I like that Barnes has an early offense, that the guys know how to make their own decisions with, based off of how the defense plays it. I like how that flows into a motion offense that's the same style, but I do wish when they're struggling to get anything done on the offensive end, how he has no ability to call some quick hitters that get the guys a look that the defense hasn't seen before. And if you call a timeout, you can make sure that everyone knows the right play to execute that way. And like a lot of people pointed out, the most frustrating thing is his reasoning for not calling a timeout makes no sense. And and even if you think it makes sense, his reasoning is, again, his fault. Like, our guys don't do what they're supposed to do, and we come out of timeouts. Well, like, you're the coach. Like, you're either coaching it or allowing it to happen. And if you're allowing your guys to not do the things you've told them to do coming out of a timeout, that's ridiculous, especially at this level and especially at this point in the season. So it's okay to be critical of those things and then move on, and we'll, of course, do that tomorrow. It's a tough one at Arkansas. It's just fans are frustrated at this point in the season because they know that, you know, the aspirations of the season are already gone.
Yeah.
But you still have to play out the string of games. I heard some people saying, hey, look, Barnes just doesn't want to go to the NIT. Like, he's just ready. He hates this season so much, he's just ready for it to be done. So he's not going to help them win a game. If they win it, great. But if they don't, who cares?
And
he's ready to just use this $5 million.
I'd say there might be something to that. I mean, it is the NIT. I do think if I'm Rick Barnes, I don't know what the practice differential is, because you can actually continue to practice after the basketball season's over. So I don't know if he would just rather practice for next year or if practicing for the NIT is worth it to him. I mean, I don't. If I'm Rick Barnes after the last 2 years of getting to the big dance, I don't know that an NIT tournament like doesn't really do a lot for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe he would rather kind of, again, let his team find themselves, make the mistakes now, coach it out of them, and if they find lightning in a bottle and now probably win the SEC tournament, okay, yeah, we'll go. Otherwise, we're going to just kind of let these guys play through it.
We'll come back with more. Stick with us. It's Hour 2, 3 and Out right here on Fan Run Radio. Hour 2 rolls on from the truly hard seltzer studios of Fan Run Radio. Pick you up some truly hard seltzer. Got the game tomorrow night. And that's about it. Barnes was really just sung the praises of Bud Walton Arena. It's a great place to play.
No, it's not.
I would have told you up until
he hasn't
a year
won there.
Ago,
why would he say that?
When we went to Rupp and it was really loud, Bud Walton Arena the year before was as loud as any place we have been since we have been in the SEC. It is definitely a great atmosphere. They love their team, and when they are playing well, it is loud.
It is a good arena. I did not realize it was quite as big as it is.
Do you have the?
Yeah, 19,368. I've been there, and I don't remember it being that big. Good for them.
I think Arkansas's fan base is slightly underrated. Like, when they're good at football, basketball, like, they're into it. And there's not much else to do.
So, yeah, no, there's nothing else. It's Arkansas. It's very we got, like, hot springs, southern. And that's it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we got that.
Yeah, we'll get to that game tomorrow. Did you see the big news out of Alabama yesterday?
I did. I even have a secondary bullet point for that story. So why don't you go ahead and lay it out there?
Alabama strength and conditioning coach Scott Cochran has apparently left to become the special teams coordinator at the University of Georgia. I feel like Scott Cochran is an institution at Alabama. I mean, he gets his own commercials now.
Yeah. I mean, he's been given a lot of the credit for Nick Saban's success there. I mean, you know, it's as much credit as you can give the strength and conditioning coach.
This is, without a doubt, the biggest loss Nick Saban has taken from a staff standpoint.
Yeah,
at his time
sense.
In Alabama. More than Kirby, more than Pruitt. This is the biggest hit. And I honestly think this makes both teams worse.
Interesting.
I say that because, one, the reports were surfacing that Cochran wanted to stay at Alabama but move to an on-field role. Nick Saban did not believe he was ready for that. Kirby decided, you know what, I'll take a shot.
It is weird to me. I mean, if you're Kirby, why not? First of all, you just make him special teams coordinator and help him with other coaches who are already familiar with doing that. But I don't know why, if you're Nick Saban, I mean, is it not better to have him there in some capacity than to lose arguably the best strength and conditioning coach in the country? And then if you're Kirby, I don't know why. I mean, I guess other than to weaken Alabama, if I'm hiring Scott Cochran, man, I'm wanting him to be in my weight room. And maybe if he's special teams coordinator, he can still kind of, here's going to be the new plan, guys. This is what it's going to look like. I'm going to go coach special teams now. But first of all, weird move for Saban to let him go. And is he going to take a pay cut?
That was the first question that
I mean, he's making a ton of money as a strength and conditioning coach. And I feel like it'd be really weird to go from strength and conditioning coach, which I think most people know this, but strength and conditioning coach is probably, outside of head coach, maybe the most important position on a staff, because I don't care what kind of plays you call offensively or defensively, if your guys aren't in great shape, if they're not bigger, stronger, and faster than the other team, there's only so much scheme can overcome. These guys, the strength and conditioning staffs at all these SEC schools, they spend way more time with the players on a day-to-day basis than the coaching staff. They're not out recruiting. They're there at 5 a.m. for workouts. They're there during practice. They're there on the sidelines at games. They are the most involved with the team on a day-to-day basis. I'm with Davey. Like, I think, you know, you lose Lane Kiffin, you lose Sarkisian, although they did re-sign him. He's back now, though, you know what I mean,
yep.
from earlier. For you've sure. lost Pruitt, you've lost Smart. It's still Nick Saban. I still think they're going to be a very, very, very good team. But this feels like, I just don't think you can replace Scott Cochran. I don't think there are five strength and conditioning coaches, I think, that are any good, and I still think Scott Cochran's the best out of the five.
I completely agree with that statement. I was going to say, if you're looking at it from Georgia's standpoint, you can at least make the argument it is addition by subtraction just because you're making your rival a little bit weaker.
Sure. I don't understand.
Like, and don't they play Alabama this year?
They
week
do. Early.
Week
like
three
or four?
Five. Yeah.
The thing that gets me is, like, this isn't like a guy that everyone else thinks is really good who came into Alabama for a year and then is leaving. Like, obviously, Scott Cochran fits in with Nick Saban's, you know, vision for the program. He's been there a long time. Like, he fits, like, he's helping mold the culture of the players for what Nick Saban wants and for what Nick Saban's had a ton of success with. So, I mean, I'm with you. Like, it can't be a philosophical difference of why Nick Saban won't put him on the field if that's what he wants.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if for Nick Saban, it's if you're not going to be my strength and conditioning coach, you're not worth the spot.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I see that too. Like,
I do too. It's just weird.
It's like Saban kind of saying, look, man, I know you've been around the on-field coaches, but that's not what you're good at.
I agree with that. I think it's weird at
like
this point in his
average,
career.
You're going to be an average on-field coach. I can go hire an above-average guy. That doesn't
exactly.
make any sense for me.
Yeah.
You're the best strength and conditioning coach. You'll be an average on-field coach. Average isn't good enough at Alabama. So if you want to – I mean, that's basically what Saban said. He said he wanted to pursue a different career path.
Which is weird. You're the – highest paid, second highest paid? Is he behind, I guess he's, is he behind the guy at Iowa and Fitzgerald?
I thought he was making more than Fitzgerald. I thought they re-upped his contract.
Did they re-up him?
But if I'm looking at it from Scott Cochran's point of view, I mean, sometimes you just get to that point in life where you're like, I need a career change. Like, I've done this. I've reached the mountaintop.
I mean, does he want to be a head coach one day? Like, is this... Like, does he think I'll go be special teams coach at Georgia, and then I'll go be the offensive or defensive coordinator at some, you know, non-Power 5 school, and then I'll get a non-Power 5 head coaching job, and then I'll be a coordinator in the SEC, and then I'll get a SEC head coaching job.
Yeah, like, if you want to take the chance, go for it, because even if, let's say, you do fail as far as being an on-the-field coach, man, like, anybody will come and hire you in a heartbeat. Like, there's no one else that's more coveted at that position in the country.
Yeah, he can always go back, right? I mean, strengthening it. Like, come on. That's not even – you don't really lose your mojo there.
He was fifth highest paid nationally in 2019. Chris Doyle at Iowa, Mickey Marotti at Ohio State. Craig Fitzgerald came in third at $625,000. Joey Batson at Clemson, $600,000. And then Cochran was right under him at $595,000. Max bonus for Cochran was $130,900. So potentially for Cochran, you could have gotten, you know, north of 700 and something. I guess that's if they win the national championship, SEC championship, I suppose. But yeah, it feels like if you go to be a special teams coordinator, having never done it before, I mean, I guess it's Kirby Smart. He can pay him whatever he wants, but it seems like you're due to take a pay cut. I just think it's kind of a surprising move. And let's be honest, too. This could have a lot to do with 12 years of working with Nick Saban might burn you out. There were a lot of fans who were pretty upset that he was doing commercials in the offseason. he and Saban. Saban's been kind of a staple in Geico commercials, or not Geico, excuse me, Aflac commercials recently. And then I've seen Scott Cochran in a couple himself. I don't know if maybe Nick Saban thought, hey, your focus isn't where it needs to be. Let me ramp some things up and make life a little bit more difficult for you. And this is a good way for him to, you know, hey, by the way, I want a job change. And if you won't give it to me, I'll go elsewhere. I mean, seems like Kirby Smart might have been the parachute that Scott Cochran needed to make the push at Alabama. Like, it feels like this may have been, like, I think he had the backup plan before going to Nick Saban, which is kind of weird. And Kirby Smart and Nick Saban. I realize that Saban got upset and mentioned Pruitt and Kirby as guys who have been kind of stealing coaches from him and stealing the system. I dare say Nick Saban would love nothing more than to groin kick Kirby Smart multiple times over based on what he's kind of poached away from Alabama in recent years. I mean, I don't necessarily blame Kirby. Like, it's a business. It's cutthroat. Again, it's still Nick Saban. It's still Alabama. But this is the first loss I've seen where it's like, oh, wait a minute. I mean, he's been there all 12 years with Nick Saban. And then all of a sudden, things, I mean, not going horribly for Alabama, but they haven't won a national championship in a couple years. And now coaches every year, it seems like, just run away from Alabama. Like, they just can't do it.
Well, and there was even something else that is kind of weird that happened on the way out the door. We'll hit that next. Stick with us right here. Hour two, three and out. Welcome back into the Truly Hard Seltzer Studios, Fan Run Radio. This segment is brought to you by MyBookie, the official sportsbook of Fan Run Radio. The Tennessee-Arkansas odds will come out tomorrow. You can get your bets in there. You got the XFL to bet on right now as well, and tons of other stuff. You can even get, there's another debate tonight. You can even get in on the political betting if you want to with MyBookie. I don't know how much Scott Cochran changing college football teams in the SEC will change the betting lines for the season, but there was some interesting fallout from it. First of all, and I didn't know this when I said this earlier in the segment, but Lane Kiffin, when he found out that Cochran was going to Georgia, said this: Scott's one of the most energetic coaches I have worked with. He developed great relationships with our players while I was at Alabama. I know that he will be successful as he moves on the field with Kirby at Georgia, and I believe he will be a head coach one day. Now, in strange but true Nick Saban news, Scott Cochran was not allowed to address the Alabama football team on his way out the door. Alabama had a players meeting at 3 o'clock, but Scott Cochran was not there. Alabama football did not let Cochran say goodbye to the team. The team continues the fourth quarter program this afternoon. It was reported by Kyle Henderson of Rivals. Kind of harsh, a little bit, right? I mean, he's been there, what, 13 years?
Yeah, 12 or 13.
Mm.
That is...
Is this... Look, like, Nick Saban's always going to have... I mean, Nick Saban could quit today, and his legacy would be legendary status, right? Like, I mean, he's done enough already. But is... I mean, it sounds like it sticks in his craw when people steal his coaches. Is that going to be what it definitely does? What ultimately, like, knocks him down enough to where he's not the guy anymore for college football, not the guy on top? Like, when you say,
what's that? Just being a jerk?
I mean, I don't know. Like,
my thing, I think I said this last year. My thing with Nick Saban is, if you're upset at your coaches leaving to take other positions with other coaches that you've also worked with, then maybe just have a better work environment. Maybe then people won't want to leave.
They don't leave Clemson. I mean, they do sometimes, but it seems
not,
to make
not
more
often.
Sense. Not like this.
Not often.
Well, it's not to take the same job. It's to take an upgrade.
Right. It's a, yeah. And this is, again, I don't know what they're going to pay him at Georgia. And I get the whole career path thing. If you're Scott Cochran and you want to become an on-field coach, okay. So that one also feels a little different. But Nick Saban loses defensive coordinators, defensive coaches, offensive coordinators and coaches every year because he's just impossible to work with.
And they'll tell you that.
Yeah.
They will say.
Lance Thompson will say, I can only do it in short bursts, like 2 or 3 years, and I've got to go recharge the battery somewhere else because it's just nonstop grinding, and it's just different. So I don't know. Like, I feel like a lot of times Nick Saban's really good at the blueprint, right, the plan. Mm-hmm. I just think he really is bad with people. And the work environment. So I just feel like if you're that upset about your coaches leaving every single year and having to redo and rebuild your staff every single year, maybe give them more incentive to stay. Maybe give them a more enjoyable work experience. That doesn't mean you have to be, you know, a 180 different than you are now, but it's the little things for a lot of these people. Like, I don't know why, if you're Nick Saban, you wouldn't have tried to work something out where Scott Cochran could do at least start to learn about some more on-field coaching while continuing in his strength and conditioning role, and then maybe you talk about a plan for next year. We're going to promote you to special teams coordinator or linebackers or whatever you wanted. But it sounds like Cochran wants the career change now, and if he wasn't going to get it at Alabama, he was out. It's just, it's strange. I don't know.
Yeah, you could have him shadow under Butch.
Maybe Scott Cochran couldn't stand
Nick
Butch
likes
Jones.
Two creams and two sugars.
Maybe he just had. Maybe he went in and said, "Listen, Coach Saban, I'm going to change my entire career path because I can't stand Butch Jones."
The fact that he was a head coach and I'm not is really painful to me. So
I'm out of here.
It's just strange. Is this Kirby swinging for the fences? Mike Griffith was on Feinbaum yesterday and said, "This is Kirby Smart just swinging for the fences." Is hiring a guy who's never been an on-field coach swinging for the fences, or is it just a good way to kind of undercut Alabama?
It's not swinging for the fences under any way you slice it. That makes no
sense. Yeah, I'm not saying Scott Cochran doesn't know football. I'm just saying he's never done it before in this position. So how much are you really helping your team as opposed to simply making life a little bit more difficult for Alabama? Also, I don't want to say it out loud, but who does Alabama look for or turn to now to replace Scott Cochran? Because, like I said, there's only four coaches in the strength and conditioning world making more than Scott Cochran. One of them is at Tennessee. You just mentioned coaches don't leave Clemson. I don't think you could go get Mickey Marotti from Ohio State. You're definitely not getting Chris Doyle away from Iowa. Does he call Craig Fitzgerald? Or are there some other potential names down on this list, like Jerry Schmidt at Texas A&M, Tommy Moffitt, who is a very well-known strength and conditioning coach in the SEC.
Promote from within. I know that's not
the
usually
the old Butch Jones move.
Well, that's different.
That's what Butch Jones is going to tell him to do.
You're reassigning someone, claiming it's a better position when in fact it's a demotion. But
Saban said, as we do with every position that opens here, we will go out and hire the best person to lead our strength and conditioning program to help our players maximize the resources available in our new sports science facility. They got a new
They just spent, hang on, I got it right here.
Wasn't it $9 million?
$9 million facility that features 21,000 square feet on the first level and 16,000 square feet on the second level. It's a weight room, 20 combination rack, platform, blah, 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 blah.
Josh Jacobs tweeted, the Raiders running back now, "Coach Cock is the glue and major key to Bama's success. Replacing him will be interesting, but I'm happy for him and that he gets to coach on the field." The players love him. Love the guy.
I mean, have you watched any of the – he's a psycho. Like, he is.
He got in trouble for smashing the, runner-up trophy.
Yeah, smashed it.
Ha-ha Clinton Dix said that he's been trying to get on the field for years. I'm happy for him. He served.
So he just finally had enough. Hey. What, it served his time? That's a weird way to put that. I don't remember the last time a strength and conditioning coach went to an on-the-field role, especially one who was regarded as one of or the best in the country. That's a very unique transition for Cochran. Boy, Nick Saban's going to try to hang about 800 on Georgia this year if he can. I promise you. I'll be here for it.
Especially if it was a little nasty at the end. It's like, hey, coach.
Well, if he didn't let him talk to the team, my guess is it was not nice and neat. Just make it nice and neat. Nope.
Sheesh.
That to me feels like a very petty move by Nick Saban, considering how much the players love him, considering how long he's been there, all the work he's done in, how widely regarded he is as one of the best, if not the best, in the business, to not even let him address the team and say thank you, goodbye, is, I mean, that's some super brainwashing there by Nick Saban to just, hey, he's the enemy now, he's gone. I mean, like, that's part of the personal aspect that I'm talking about. Like, Nick Saban can't separate business and personal. It's all business. All you got to do is let the guy go in and say, see you later.
I get that. I guess, if anything, I would say it's more of Saban being paranoid due to...
No, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, he doesn't want them to like Cochran. Mm-hmm. He wants to brainwash them into thinking that Cochran turned his back on the team and the program. And so by not letting him talk to the team, not letting him giving him a chance to explain his decision and the move, Nick Saban can now spin this as however he wants. And if you know Nick Saban, he loves to point how everybody doesn't believe in you, blah, 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 blah. He's going to turn this into he thought he had a better opportunity at Georgia. Let's prove him wrong, which is just creepy.
I think Saban also knows that before long, the rule for like a one-time free transfer is going to be coming up for debate. Well, it's already up for debate, but will actually be happening soon. And losing one of your best player or your best coaches to the other school that a program those players love.
No, I agree. That's part of it, though. Like, he'd rather brainwash them and turn them against Scott Cochran than to allow him to just tell the truth.
9 Alabama players are transferring to Georgia.
I mean, would you be stunned?
No.
After, if let's say that one transfer rule was passed today, would you be stunned to see a lot of Bama players just say, oh, man, we're going to Georgia?
Or even after that, like, even if that doesn't happen, but after this season, a lot of players are having a grad transfer a year. Yeah. Maybe didn't play a ton there.
I think that'll happen. I absolutely think that'll happen.
No, that new rule's going to pass. I mean, they don't come out with that stuff if it's going to fail. So I would expect it to. We'll come back, final segment, hour two, next. Let's go! Final segment, hour number two of the program. Carousel always turns in the SEC.
Did you see that Colorado finally got their man?
Oh, they did. Yeah.
I forgot his name.
I can't remember it either. He's with the Dolphins?
Yeah, OC for the Dolphins. I think.
The Dolphins.
The Miami Dolphins.
Such a great year.
Better than people expected. I mean, they won 6 out of their last 9.
Nice.
Okay.
Hadn't Tennessee lost 6 of their last 9?
In basketball, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your favorite days here at the NFL Combine?
It was yesterday, unfortunately.
Well, no, they're still measuring people today.
But not quarterbacks.
Not quarterbacks, though.
Yeah, we got the hand size measurements. It's always interesting how people freak out about hand size. I do think it's important. I don't know to what extent it is important.
Well, do you remember during the season when it was first of all, there was a SEC game that the weather was really nasty, and then I feel like maybe it was Jake Fromm with some weather issues, and it always seemed like he couldn't throw the football very well when it was raining.
Okay.
That's what the NFL people say. They say it doesn't really matter when the weather's good. Hand size, who cares? When the weather gets bad, that's when it matters. Quarterbacks, small hands, struggle in bad weather. Barrett Salee, I think, threw out the stats about Joe Burrow. He was actually pretty good in games where it rained during pregame or during the game itself. But that's the story. Joe Burrow has small hands.
I mean, I don't feel like they're that small.
They weren't. Yeah, they weren't tiny.
Let's see here. I think I've got him. Yeah, Joe Burrow came in at 9 inches exactly. Tua Tagovailoa apparently had a 10-inch right hand, but 9 7/8 on his throwing hand.
I thought it was the opposite.
Well, he's a lefty.
Yeah, I thought his left hand was 10 inches.
No, his left hand is 9 7/8.
Well, somebody had that backwards then, because I'm.
his throwing hand was smaller than his other hand, which was just kind of weird.
That is
weird. Justin Herbert, 10 inches. Jacob Eason, 9.5. Jalen Hurts, 9.75. I did read that Jake Fromm's throwing hand, due to a pinky, like, being deformed.
I thought it was Tua. That's why his is smaller.
No, it was, well, his is just smaller, but apparently Jake Fromm has, like, a deformed finger.
Man, there were so many different.
Yeah, I heard Tua as well. Was
I don't think his was deformed. One just happened to be. Mm. I mean, I was listening to the Blitz yesterday. Unless they got Jake Fromm and.
Tua's left hand is 10 inches.
Okay, that's. I mean, I'm just reading what.
I look up Jake Fromm, pinky deformed, and all I get is Georgia's lineman to transfer amid lawsuit over dad's severed finger.
Yeah. I mean, Barstool Sabermetrics tweets out quarterback hand size, Tua Tagovailoa, 9.875.
Pro Football Talk says, has an article all about it. It says 10 inches for the left hand, 9.875 for the right.
He is left handed, though. I'm not crazy.
He is left handed. Yeah, his throwing hand's bigger.
Okay. Well, I don't know why Barstool would mess that up. Shouts out to Sabermetrics. I feel like they're supposed to be pretty accurate. John Akre tweets in and says, Mahomes' hands are only 9.25 inches. Yeah, he and Joe Burrow are now being like buddy-buddy about having small hands. I do love that people were probably freaking out over hand size yesterday. Like people who thought, oh, yeah, we're going to be able to get Jake Fromm late. Wait, what? He has what? Wasn't his under 8?
No. No, it was like just barely under 9.
Whose was?
Not. Yeah, that's Fromm. What I meant. Fromm. Under. It was like 8 something.
8.875.
We measured ours. What was yours?
9.5.
Okay.
I think
mine was 9.125.
I said it yesterday. Like outside of weight, like I pretty much stack up exactly the same as Jake Fromm.
You pretty much could be Jake Fromm.
Yeah. Every single statistic they had, I was like within like half an inch on wingspan. Hand size was the same. Height's the same.
Yeah, that's really all I got. I just love when the hand size comes out and everyone starts freaking out. Yeah, you should absolutely enter the draft. Just see what happens. Mm. Maybe you could get, you know, an XFL camp invite or something. You know, next year.
True.
When does the actual events start? Is that Thursday?
Correct.
Okay. The running and the...
Da-da-da-da. It is?
Yeah.
They used to run it Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday.
They changed it. I thought it was Thursday through Sunday now.
It used to be they would run all the players you wanted to see, all the offensive guys Saturday and Sunday, and then Monday and Tuesday would be the defensive backs and linebackers and defensive linemen. I used to like the combine more. Okay. I don't know why it's waned.
I mean, I don't either, because they're getting more coverage than ever.
Yeah, it is now Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
So
Thursday's tight end, quarterbacks, wideouts. Friday is the specialists, the offensive line, the running backs. And then you have defensive line, linebackers Saturday and defensive backs Sunday.
You can watch all that on the NFL Network.
I mean, how much does height matter with quarterbacks? I feel like
not as much as it used to.
No. In fact, there was... I think two of the biggest hand sizes in the NFL currently are Russell Wilson and Drew Brees, which is interesting because they're obviously two short guys.
Yeah.
One obviously has the ability to run in Russell Wilson, and the other is just a dynamite all-time pocket passer in Brees. But it does appear that if you're a smaller quarterback, hand size helps you out in a very, very big way. Whereas Tom Brady, I think, is only... Is he 9-inch hands? 9.25? About the same size as Mahomes, and... Obviously, Tom Brady, one of the most prolific passers of all time. I don't know if it matters nearly as much as some people think. What was Drew Lock last year? Was it 8.5? I mean, we called him baby hands for a long time. Drew Lock in the back half of the season for the Broncos actually looked okay. Had a couple of weeks where I think he was that division's player of the week. So maybe it doesn't matter nearly as much. But I know that was a big deal with... Who was it? Was it Randall Cunningham with the Vikings? He had really small hands. He could throw the deep ball, but if anyone got pressure or touched him, basically, he would just fumble it.
I believe this is for 2018, but Tom Brady, they have all the starters listed. And, well, where's Tom at? Can't believe. I know Jared Goff has the smallest hands. He's got 9-inch hands, exactly at 9.
So Fromm's smaller than any starting quarterback in the league currently.
Tom is 9.38.
Okay.
Tua, they're talking about his medical. You know, obviously everybody's focused on the hip, but he's had that tightrope surgery on both ankles.
Mm-hmm.
He's had surgery on a broken index finger on his left hand, his throwing hand, last March, and played through a knee injury. So an AFC scout said it's all about durability with Tua, and his, you know, the style that he plays. That the problem is his injury history. So,
yep. I mean, I feel like we kind of knew that. Yeah. I mean, the extent of the injuries, and then is it a injury-prone thing, or is it just bad luck?
I think Justin Herbert measuring in tall, and it's the fact that he ran the ball effectively in their bowl game, the last game of the season, I think will be good for him. He showed he's you know, more of an athletic guy, kind of like Burrow. You know, no one talks about Burrow running, but he's, you know.
Joe Burrow really said he's contemplating retirement after realizing that his hands are that small.
Oh. Yeah, that would be a problem.
Your hands are an important part of your family.
Your quarterback profile. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I guess means we need a break.
I guess we didn't need a break.
Are we ready for a break? We're not ready for a break.
It's going to time it up. It's going to kind of hard out it like when Travis messes it up and has to go, Fox?
Sports.
Radio. Yeah.
Truly hard.
That stuff.
Seltzer. Studio. NFL Draft.
Oh, yeah. Just comment. Let it play and then tell me when the ad ended.
That's.